Welcome to this episode of On The Case, the LSE Law Society's podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Tan. In each episode, we speak to various professionals and experts to gain insight into legal careers, law school, and other exciting developments in the world of law. Without further ado, sit back and enjoy the show.
Hello everyone. For my last podcast episode of the year, I have invited Sir Mark Lyle Grant, who kindly accepted the invitation to talk to us about the erosion of rules-based international order. This theme describes a phenomenon which has been taking place at a global scale, consisting of a declining rule of law at an international level, represented by the growing disrespect demonstrated by global leaders towards treaties, conventions, and international organizations. Sir Mark has served as the UK ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations from 2009 to 2015, and presided the UN Security Council on four occasions. He was also the National Security Advisor from 2015 to 2017, and has also served for many years in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, where he worked alongside many countries and organizations, such as the EU, defending the foreign interests of the UK. He is therefore in a privileged position to talk about this topic, given his past interactions with the many different countries and continents and experience in dealing with diplomatic affairs. Other than all of this, he is a qualified barrister who was appointed to the bench of the Middle Temple in 2011, and therefore even more of a perfect fit to our podcast. I hope you enjoy it. Hello, Sir Mark Lyle Grant. Good morning. It is a huge pleasure to have you here with us today. Our conversation will focus on the erosion of rules-based international order, which I believe is an incredibly relevant topic given the current state of affairs, both in Europe and the whole world. Well, to begin with, on our last episode with Professor Jeffrey Sachs, he told us that he's still incredibly fascinated with the existence and the workings of the UN, despite recognizing that there are some failures with certain bodies, including the Security Council. As someone who presided the UN Security Council in four occasions, do you share this same fascination or has this experience dealing with stubborn and bureaucratic diplomats killed off any hope that you had in the UN?
Well, it's certainly deeply frustrating working at the United Nations for obvious reasons. I did it for 5.5 years, sitting in the Security Council with the Russians and the Chinese and trying to grapple with the sort of conflicts around the world like Libya, Syria, Crimea, etc. And it is undoubtedly true that when the vital interests of one of the veto powers, the five veto powers, are engaged, then it's really impossible for the Security Council to do anything. But nonetheless, despite that frustrating experience, I come away from New York with an underlying faith in the United Nations system, because it is the only universal forum. It is the only place where all 193 sovereign countries come together. And therefore, if it didn't exist, we would undoubtedly have to invent it. So despite its flaws, I think the United Nations is a necessary international organization. And it is striking that even in today's world, which is deeply fragmented and the world order is falling apart, that no one is leaving the United Nations. You know, all the countries are still there. They're still engaging with each other on a daily basis. And that has some value.
I remember listening to a speech that you gave in a conference back in 2020, if I'm not mistaken, where you spoke about the reasons why the UN was created and depicted the world pre-UN as being governed by a system of the law of the jungle. Well, right now here in the UK, we don't have to go too far to find a completely atrocious conflict from which war crimes and genocide allegations have already emerged. Are we back to this anarchical law of the jungle?
Well, there is a danger that we are sliding back into that system, but I think it's worth looking back at how the system evolved a little bit, Antonio, because after the Second World War, a new set of institutions and norms and regulations were established. And because they were established by the winners of the Second World War, they were established in that image, a Western image, if you like, in support of open trade, the rule of law, human rights, etc. And that was the sort of flourishing period. And, you know, throughout the Cold War, despite the polarization of the world at that time, although the Soviet Union didn't want to engage with that order, nonetheless, they were forced to do so. They preferred to do things bilaterally in terms of the nuclear negotiations with the United States, but they didn't disturb that order, even if they didn't engage properly with it. Then at the end of the Cold War, in 1989, you had a flourishing of the golden era of this liberal international order, when suddenly the UN Security Council was alive again and established a huge number of UN peacekeeping missions across the Middle East and in Africa to try and prevent conflicts in Africa and the Middle East. And you had the Human Rights Council was established. You had the arms trade treaty was agreed. You had women's rights, LGBT rights flourished. You had responsibility to protect was put forward, humanitarian intervention. Now, what is striking about all these initiatives that happened at that time is that every single one went in a rights-based direction and was initiated by the West. So even though there was some opposition from a number of countries at that time, because when I was at the United Nations, we used to talk about the A team and the B team. And the A team were the activists who wanted to use the international system to do things and resolve global problems. And the B team were the blockers who basically wanted to preserve the status quo. Now, that golden era lasted about 20, 25 years until around 2013, 2014, 2015. And suddenly at that time, and I was at the UN at that time, you saw a more systematic pushback against this liberal international order, led by Russia, China, but also conservative Muslim countries, also some right-wing NGOs, the Holy See. And the sharp end of the pushback was on LGBT rights. And that then led into opposition on women's rights and then into political and civil rights. And that is the reason, I think, the origin of this pushback that is now you're referring to in terms of the law of the jungle reasserting itself. And I think there are three main reasons why we've seen this more systematic pushback. The first was the military interventions in Iraq and Libya. And there's no doubt that many countries felt that the Western world had gone beyond the mandate given to it by the UN Security Council and was trying to impose democratic norms on more reluctant developing countries and even to go for regime change. You then had the financial crisis of 2008, which undermined faith in the ruling elite's ability to manage global capitalism. And then you had the geopolitical shifts, obviously, with the rise of China and a number of other rising powers. And I think those three factors came together to give substance to the opposition to this liberal rules-based order. And since then, we have seen a rapid deterioration, greater authoritarianism, greater populism, and a number of factors have exacerbated that. So you're absolutely right that I think there is a risk now of reverting to the sort of pre-Second World War period where might is right and the big countries can impose their will on smaller countries. And that is extremely damaging, I think, for the overall world order.
Your answer links perfectly to my following question, which is related to another interview that you gave around 2020, where you were asked to speak a bit about your role as National Security Advisor. And I remember that at the time you were asked to list some of the main threats to national security here in the UK. And one of them was, you mentioned Russia, and this was in 2020, I believe. And indeed, it is true that the invasion of Crimea had already taken place, that Putin clearly showed that he much preferred an aggressive and militaristic regime. But the truth is that the other day I was looking into some news reports from that same period, and I remember seeing many calls from both Macron and many other European leaders calling for more dialogue, calling for a more passive attitude towards Russia. Given both of these facts, I think that there are only two possible options here. You either had a time machine at the time, or we all simply failed to deal with this huge threat that has preparing for war during all these years. How come we failed
well,
so bad?
There was a strong Western response to the annexation of Crimea in 2014. I called the very first emergency meeting of the UN Security Council to deal with it the following day. And we had, I think, something like 29 emergency meetings of the Security Council to deal with the various aspects of the Crimean annexation and the invasion of the eastern Donbass and the shooting down, don't let's not forget, of the Malaysian civilian airline, which killed 298 odd people. So we did try to put pressure on Russia, but of course Russia vetoed all those resolutions that we put forward. And then there was a feeling that Ukraine was under some pressure on the battlefield. And that is when France and Germany exerted some pressure on the Ukrainian president to come to agreement with Russia. And that led to the Minsk I and Minsk II agreements. And the danger of having agreements that are imposed, if you like, on one of the parties because they're under pressure on the battlefield is that they are not necessarily sustainable. And in order to even get agreement, there are a lot of ambiguities. So both Minsk treaties are full of ambiguous language about the sequencing of what happens first, what happens next. So the United Kingdom government was not involved in those talks directly. And we were fairly worried about the impact of them at the time. And I could see then that it was likely that they would lead to greater disputes down the road. And undoubtedly, that's what happened. Because Russia claims that Ukraine never abided by some of the terms of the treaty, and Russia, of course, never abided by certain obligations that it had under those treaties. And that indirectly led to a feeling that, from Putin's point of view, that he could violate further the international order by ordering the full-scale invasion of Ukraine last year. So you're absolutely right that France and Germany were more enthusiastic about bringing the conflict to an end at whatever cost than Britain. And I think in retrospect, they were probably made too many concessions to Putin in securing those agreements.
This conflict has also said a lot about the theme of our episode today and rules-based international order, because it clearly showed the flaws of international law. First of all, it is obviously non-binding, and at any point a country can bypass it, just like Russia did recently in relation to the New START agreement on nuclear arms control. Is there any alternative to the current model of international law that could perhaps guarantee some more entrenchment in domestic law, or will we be forever dependent on the willingness of political leaders?
I think we will continue for some years to be dependent on the willingness of the leaders of the big countries to enforce the international order. I mean, there are legal norms. I mean, it's a question of their enforcement, and that is where it does. Undoubtedly, what Russia has done and what China is doing in certain aspects, for instance, militarizing the South China Sea, is against international law. So they are in violation of international law. The question is, how does one enforce that law? And in the system that we have at the moment, it is not going to be possible to implement those that international law against leaders of big countries that aren't prepared to do it. Now, what is disappointing to me is that you need to bear in mind that the international community is made up of a majority of small countries, countries under 5-10 million people. As a large majority, over 100 countries have less than 10 million people in the world. And it is those who are most vulnerable if we have a return to law of the jungle. And it is those who, on the whole, have indeed voted to condemn Russian annexation of Crimea and invasion of Ukraine. But there are some countries that have not done that. And that is disappointing, because if we do revert to a sort of Cold War mentality or big economic blocks fighting each other, it will be the smaller countries around the world that will undoubtedly suffer from that. But unfortunately, there is no alternative type of governance that will improve the situation. President Xi of China has talked occasionally of reforming the international order in a way more suited to China's interests, so with Chinese, what he calls Chinese characteristics. Now, we don't know exactly what that means, but there's no doubt that it would be based on very different value system than the liberal international order that I mentioned established after World War II. And because of that, it will never be acceptable to most democratic countries around the world. So it's not as though China has an alternative model of world governance that would avoid the problems that we have today. They are just doing it to support their own national interests. So at the moment, I think we have to defend what we believe in, which is the international order, but of course be prepared to amend it, shape it, improve it, not least to give more input, more authority to some of the rising powers like China, but also like Brazil, South Africa, India, Japan, etc. And I think that can be done, but it needs to be done in a way that doesn't fundamentally undermine the basic pillars of the international order that has kept, let us not forget, global stability and indeed fostered global prosperity over the last 75 years.
Of course. During your time working with the UN, did you feel that there was an attempt by China to shift the global balance of power and the global influence on international affairs for themselves rather than the US? Or has this been a more recent thing since the Trump administration?
I think it's relatively more recent. China played a very strange role at the UN in the 5.5 years I was there, in that in the General Assembly, they and the wider UN family, they presented themselves as poor developing country that was on the side of the G77 against these wealthy Western powers who were trying to dictate things. So they were very much the underdogs and the champion of the underdogs. And a lot of other countries went along with that sort of self-description that the Chinese had. In the Security Council, China was entirely passive. Unlike Russia. You know, in my time, Russia probably came up with 100 initiatives, most of them deeply unhelpful, but some of them helpful on counterterrorism, for instance, on counter-piracy. You know, we were able to work with Russia in a number of areas in the Security Council. But in that time, there was not a single initiative from China. So they were entirely subordinate to Russia, which was surprising, and it was something that I found quite difficult to explain to ministers in London, because obviously in terms of the power ratio between the two countries, China was already well ahead of Russia and going further ahead. But in the Security Council, they were entirely subordinate to Russia. So although, for instance, they were very happy with some of the draft resolutions that we put forward on Syria, for example, they agreed that they would veto alongside Russia just to give Russia some comfort and some support at a political level. Now, that will gradually change as China becomes more assertive and Russia becomes more defensive and on the back foot at the United Nations. But that was the characterization that I had. So these ideas of President Xi, of new Chinese characteristics and a new world order rather than just a bigger place for China in the old world order, is something that is actually quite recent in the last 5, 6, 7 years.
Thank you. Now that we've spoken about Russia's contribution to the weakening of respect for international treaties and conventions, I'd like to ask whether Russia is the outlier or this has been witnessed all around the world. This question comes especially at the time where here in the UK, a country that has always been known for its respect for international law and international treaties, there are ongoing talks for the potential withdrawal from the European Convention on Human Rights. How do you see this? And Is the UK contributing to the weakening of international treaties?
Well, I think you can certainly make the argument that if you are a staunch defender of the international order and international governance and international treaties, then you shouldn't be doing anything in your national capacity which weakens that approach. And undoubtedly, there have been some decisions taken by the British government which are highly questionable in that area, and pulling out of the European Convention of Human Rights obviously would be a negative step in that direction. On the other hand, these are very minor bending, if you like, of the international rules or weakening of the rules compared to what Russia and China are doing, and one shouldn't compare the two things. So I think there will always be a time when certain countries' individual national interests are so strong that they feel unable to participate. And it is much better in those circumstances to pull out of the convention entirely, which is a legitimate thing to do. And every convention has the has a clause which allows you to do that, rather than stay in it and flout it. So it would be more honest of Russia, for instance, to pull out of the United Nations because they have violated the fundamental principles of sovereignty, which are underpin the entire UN charter, than to claim that they're not doing it. So in that sense, I think Britain is being more honest by saying, look, I don't think we can stay inside the European Convention of Human Rights and pursue the immigration policy or whatever it is that we want to do.
Yeah, just on the last thing you said, if it did happen, if Russia ended up by leaving the UN, would you say that the UN Security Council would have more power to act against them, or would it still be quite powerless?
Well, it would certainly be freed up in a number of areas which would allow them to adopt binding resolutions, because resolutions adopted by the Security Council are legally binding on all states, whether they're on the Security Council or not on the Security Council, or indeed whether they're members of the United Nations or not members of the United Nations. So it's never going to happen, because Russia realizes that there would be a whole slew of new obligations and sanctions that would be imposed upon them. And unfortunately, they can't be thrown out of the United Nations or the UN Security Council itself without their own agreement. So it won't happen. But if it were to happen, if they did decide to pull out, then undoubtedly the Security Council would be liberated to take a much more coercive action.
As my last question on this topic, I want to know if you have any ideas of possible solutions to this current state of affairs. How can we grow back respect for UN and international law? How can we make it stronger, and how can we encourage people and actually show the UN works and that its work is being effective?
Well, I think this is where the sort of the mythical silent majority can come into play, because I say the majority of members of the United Nations, of sovereign states around the world, are small countries, and they have the greatest vested interest in not seeing a return to might is right and law of the jungle. And therefore, they need to come up with a much more, I think, vociferous and vocal approach to say, look, we may not be happy with everything that has happened over the last 75 years, but we can see that if the entire international system breaks down, then we are going to suffer and our country's sovereignty will be completely destroyed, and indeed our countries could eventually disappear entirely. So in that circumstance, I think we need to try to mobilize that middle ground to be more forceful. And the more that we can see that the outliers like Russia are marginalized and don't have the support of other countries, the higher the chance that they will adhere to the international legal system. So I think that is the best bet. As I say, also we need to adapt the current governance arrangements to ensure that rising powers do feel part of the system and therefore are prepared to defend the system. So they need to be given a greater role and a greater to say, not just at the UN in terms of Security Council reform, etc., but in terms of voting rights in the IFIs, in terms of new institutions that are being developed. It is striking, for instance, that the country that is most opposed to reform modernization of the UN Security Council is in fact China. It's not the Western countries, the powers, it's not even Russia. It is actually China, because China does not want to see Japan or India, its two main regional rivals, who are obvious candidates for permanent membership, being given that status in the UN Security Council. And it's actually China that is blocking reform of the Security Council more than any other single country. So if they can be persuaded to change their position, you reform the Security Council, expand it, that I think would also help show these rising powers that they have a vested interest in the new world order.
Thank you. To repeat a classic question to our guests, that is usually our final question, I'd like to set aside this topic and just ask you for some advice for law students, or just generally university students who are growing up in this increasingly challenging world.
Well, I think it's easy at the moment for the younger generation to feel that they've got a raw deal, that in fact, because of the global challenges and the economic challenges, that they are not going to have the opportunities of their parents of previous generations. And I think that that is actually wrong. I think there are more opportunities for young people than there have ever been, whether that's simple things like just sort of cheap travel around the world, but also in terms of the type of work that they can do. You know, the fact that there is no inhibition on people from less privileged backgrounds in getting to university, in then getting really good jobs that would have been denied them 20, 30, certainly 50 years ago. You know, we're living in a country that has got, you know, has abolished a whole or abandoned a whole range of discriminations and prejudices that were very common until literally the last 5 to sort of 10 years. So I think it is a very good time to be a young person, and young people have the ability to influence events as never before. You know, you've only got to look at some of the young activists like, you know, Greta Thunberg on the climate debate, for instance. You look at the young entrepreneurial people in IT who are millionaires at the age of, you know, 25, 26. These things never happened in past generations, and does give an opportunity for young people to influence events, including domestic politics, but also international politics. And I think those opportunities should be taken. So yes, there are challenges. There's the short-term challenges, if you like, of all the conflicts around the world, terrorism and cybercrime, etc. You've got the longer-term challenges of climate change and you know, uncontrolled migrations and issues which are going to change our world. But I still think it is a fantastic time to be a young person, and having a good training, whether it's a law training, as I had, and you have, and others have, or any other good educational background, you know, sets you up for a very fulfilling and happy life. So I would give a message of encouragement and hope for the younger generation rather than one of despair.
Thank you so much. Thank you for this incredibly valuable talk. I'm sure our listeners have enjoyed learning from you as much as I did. And I hope that you enjoyed our conversation as well.
Thank you very much, Antonio, for the invitation.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning into this episode of On the Case, the LSC Law Society's podcast. Further information and our contact details can be found in the description of this episode. Don't forget to follow us at LSCSU Law Soc on Instagram or on LinkedIn at LSC's On the Case. See you next time!